Welcome to the IVF Journey with Dr. Michael Chapman, the podcast for couples who struggle with infertility and want to fulfill their dreams of becoming parents. In this podcast, you'll learn actionable strategies to deal with infertility from Dr. Michael Chapman, or Prof as he's affectionately known. Prof is the co-founder of IVF Australia and is a leading Australian infertility specialist who has helped over 3,000 couples realise their dreams of becoming parents. To access previous episodes packed with ideas, solutions and tips that actually work, head over to Dr. Chapman's IVF podcast on iTunes. You can also ask questions by contacting Dr. Chapman's rooms on 1-800-111-483 or by emailing him, michael.chapman@ivf.com.au.
That first cry of a baby born after the long journey of IVF remains one of the most beautiful experiences in the world. As an obstetrician and an IVF specialist, I've had the privilege of experiencing this over many thousands of times in my long career, but I still remain moved by each baby's first cry. It signifies the end of a long journey and the beginning of a new life. This is Professor Michael Chapman, co-founder of IVF Australia and host of the IVF Journey podcast. Thanks for tuning in. To access all the previous episodes, head over to my website, www.theivfjourney.com, and select IVF Journey Podcast from the navigation menu. You'll also be able to find the various services that we provide at IVF Australia. Today we're going to talk about male infertility. Obviously the male is a vital part of conception, even though science today claims that we can generate sperm without having to have normal testicles. That's happened in mice, but it certainly hasn't yet happened in men. So we do need sperm. The testing for sperm and the quantity of the sperm is a vital part of the initial investigations of infertility. I've certainly come across patients who've been given fertility drugs, women who've been given fertility drugs for months on end, without actually testing the male on the assumption that the male was okay. But the evidence is quite clear. Male infertility accounts for 40% of all infertility. Defects in the sperm numbers, the swimmingness of the sperm, and their survival inside the womb and in the fallopian tubes accounts for a substantial part of the reasons why couples don't conceive. So that initial sperm test is a vital part of the journey. In a normal male, he should be producing 15 million sperm per milliliter of ejaculate, of the fluid that comes out at the time of ejaculation. Evidence is clear that as the levels drop below that 15 million, the odds of a pregnancy fall off quite dramatically. At 5 million, the chances of pregnancy are reduced by something like 80% compared with a normal count. The sperm count, however, is not the whole story. The sperm have to be able to swim because they've got a journey relative to their size, which is the equivalent of walking 12 miles as they go from the neck of the womb in the vagina where they're deposited all the way up through the womb and finding their way into the fallopian tube where hopefully an egg is waiting to be fertilised. It seems that we need something in the order of 50 to 100,000 sperm surrounding the egg for fertilisation to occur at a normal rate. That fertilisation is occurring, as I said earlier, in the fallopian tube. So the swimmingness of the sperm, its motility, is a parameter that we look for very closely when we do a sperm test. One of the commonest reasons for reduced motility is that once a sample is produced, the motility of those sperm decline quite dramatically if we wait for more than an hour to process the sperm. So sperm outside the body at room temperature deteriorates quite quickly in terms of motility. So one of the commonest issues is when a sperm sample is taken to a local laboratory collecting point and it takes 4 hours to get to the actual laboratory. We get a result back that says The count's normal, but the motility is low. That's not the sperm's problem. That's the laboratory's problem in getting to it quick enough. So we always recommend that samples are produced and processed within the hour by the sample being either produced on site or being brought quite quickly after production at home. We also look at the morphology of the sperm. What do I mean by morphology? Morphology is shape. And what we know is that a normally shaped sperm looks a bit like a tadpole. It's got a head, a neck, and a tail. Interestingly, in the millions of sperm that we produce, there are actually only a very tiny percentage that fulfill the criteria of being tall, dark, and handsome. In other words, they've got normal heads, normal necks, and normal tails that propel them along normally. Indeed, taking a very specific criteria for sperm morphology, only 4 to 5% of all sperm actually fulfill that criteria. But we know they are the ones most likely to fertilize an egg. So assessing morphology is another essential part of the process of establishing whether a sperm sample is normal or not. That assessment of morphology is actually quite a tricky process, because what we're doing is, with the naked eye, without the help of computers, actually determining what is normal and what is not. You know, is someone who's 5'6" normal, or is the person that's 6 foot, are they normal? It's getting down to that level of differentiation that decides a normal sperm count. Those three parameters that I've just described, the actual concentration, the actual swimmability of the sperm, and their shape, all contribute to the assessment of whether a sperm sample is normal or not. More sophisticated testing has indicated that there are men who do not produce pregnancies because the genetic material in the head of the sperm is abnormal, that it's undergone oxidation that breaks down the chromosome strands and therefore makes those sperm unlikely to produce a pregnancy. Or if a pregnancy is produced, it may produce an increased miscarriage rate. This DNA fragmentation, as it is called, can be assessed. And the good news about that is it can be treated. So once we have the sperm test done and the couple come back to see the IVF specialist, the fertility specialist, then they will be counseled in relation to that result. If there is abnormalities, i.e. the sperm count is low, the motility is poor, or the morphology is poor, or if we have high levels of DNA fragmentation, the specialist will discuss the chances of success, either in spontaneous pregnancy or with treatment with IVF. These discussions may involve further investigations. So the range of abnormalities, at the worst, there is no sperm at all. That is called azoospermia. And obviously, a pregnancy can never occur if there's no sperm in the ejaculate. Confronting this issue with a couple for the first time is one of my more challenging consultations. To tell a man they have no sperm is a real kick in the groin. I've often had the wives in tears when I've broken that news to them, because from their perspective, that initial comment to them means they'll never be able to have a baby. Now, in a significant number of cases, that's not the case, that either we can stimulate sperm to be produced, or we can collect sperm directly from the testicle, or we can use donor sperm. The issue of azoospermia raises a number of diagnostic problems. The causes of no sperm can be, firstly, that the production line, which is a quite a complex process, never formed, that the cells that were laid down time of embryogenesis. In other words, when the embryo was forming inside the mother's womb, the specific cells that produce sperm were not laid down. It's called Sertoli cell only syndrome. The only way we can find that out is to do a biopsy, take a sample of the testicle to look under the microscope. The next problem can be that, again, at the time of the development of the baby in utero, the tube leading from the testicle out to the penis did not grow, did not develop. That tube's called the vas deferens, and the problem is called absence, congenital absence of the vas. Not common, but it is associated with cystic fibrosis. The next is that when ejaculation occurs, what normally happens is the sperm comes from the testicle down into the penis and obviously comes out into the bigger wide world. But there can be a situation, and diabetics are one of the groups that this happens in, the muscular contractions that enable this to occur actually force the sperm back into the bladder rather than out into the big wide world. That's called retrograde ejaculation. There are rare causes of the production line not working because the hormones that stimulate it coming from the brain are suppressed. So this is happening at the level of the brain, that the hormones from the pituitary gland are not being secreted, and therefore the production line switches off. This can happen under severe stress. It can happen in situations of malnutrition, and there can be abnormalities in the brain, in the message areas of the brain, that stop the production of those particular hormones, LH and FSH. The other causes of azoospermia are when these hormones that I've just described are suppressed by taking medications that switch off the pituitary gland. And I have to say, increasingly, I'm seeing men coming to my clinic who, in the name of bodybuilding or masculinity or manliness, have believed that by taking testosterone or anabolic steroids, usually through gyms, will be good for them. It may be good for their egos, but it's certainly not good for sperm production because it switches it off. And it's surprising how often, once I send the wife out of the room, the husband will confess that he has been on these drugs. In most cases, it is irreversible, but in some situations, I've seen azoospermia persist despite stimulating the pituitary gland to produce hormones or directly stimulating the testicles. So I have a very negative view about men taking these steroids for the purposes of being more masculine. The next level of abnormality is when there is a very low sperm count, when sperm are present, but there are low numbers. And because we need large numbers to actually do that journey from the neck of the womb up to the fallopian tube, these low number counts of 4 or 5 million or less rarely produce a pregnancy. This is also because while the numbers are down, there's also an increase in poor swimming capacity and an increase in abnormal forms of the sperm. These men will produce pregnancies spontaneously from time to time, but incredibly rarely. Then there's the intermediate group with sperm counts between 5 and 15 million, where spontaneous pregnancies are slightly more likely, but still nowhere near what can be achieved if you have a normal sperm count with normal morphology and normal motility. In the lowest ones, less than 5 million, we do tend to do more investigations because what we find is something like 15 to 20% of these have a genetic origin. That on the Y chromosome, which is the male chromosome, which has the bits of the chromosome that produce normal sperm production, that there can be deletions of some of those genes and therefore lead to this problem. This is important to know for two reasons. One, at least it gives the male an understanding of why they don't have such a good sperm count. And secondly, if we do achieve a pregnancy with those sperm, it is more likely that their male child will have a similar issue in the future. The treatment of poor semen quality, male infertility, unfortunately, is relatively unsuccessful. To actually move a sperm count from where it's been tested to be in the lower range back into the normal range is almost unachievable. I've mentioned a couple of things that might be reversible. I've mentioned stress, suppressing pituitary hormones, so relief of that stress can improve sperm counts. I've mentioned hormone suppression, either through the use of steroids, anabolic steroids. By removing them and stopping using them, then sometimes, and mostly, sperm counts do get better. But for the vast majority, giving hormones, giving adjuvants, taking tablets that you might have read on the net and improve sperm quality and counts, there's no scientific evidence this makes any difference whatsoever. There's one group of men with poor semen quality where the cause is thought to be varicose veins around the testicles. These warm up the testicle and slow down sperm production. We know that men in some occupations where their testicles are overheated, sperm counts are more likely to be lower. Blast furnace workers has been shown in one European country to predispose to lower sperm counts. When God set us up, he had the testicles outside the human body, dangling down in the scrotum, to produce a lower temperature than normal body temperature as the best temperature in which to produce sperm. So the testicular temperature is something like 35 degrees as opposed to normal body temperature of 37 plus. So if there's anything that warms the testicles on a long-term basis, then you're likely to get reduced sperm production. And varicose veins can do that. They have to be quite severe, but it is controversial as to whether getting rid of those varicose veins, either by tying them off or obstructing them, ultimately makes any difference. Randomized controlled trials have shown both positive and negative results. So whether we should go ahead and deal with varicose veins is still a very debatable point. But in the absence of anything else, we do those procedures for the severe cases. The best way of quantifying the severity is a ultrasound of the testicles and the scrotum. And that's pretty much a standard test in men. Once they've been examined and found to have some varicose veins, it's worth doing. The ultrasound has a secondary benefit in that there is a small relationship between low sperm counts and testicular cancer. And certainly doing an ultrasound can help us in that diagnosis. So there is a bit of extra information we can gain by doing such a test. So where does that leave us with male infertility? The intermediate group, there is some of this group who, while they have reduced sperm counts, the percentage of good sperm is still there. And we can use that sperm for intrauterine insemination. If on further testing with what we call a trial wash or a sperm separation test, we identify that there's a good percentage of normal sperm. I describe this test to patients by saying basically what we're doing is throwing the sperm sample into one end of a swimming pool and then walking up to the other end of the swimming pool, collecting the sperm an hour later that have made the distance, made the other end of the pool. And if that number is good, then whatever the total count is, if they have a good number of motile sperm, then it's still possible to use that sperm without having to go to IVF and doing IUI. That's a small group, however. The vast majority will require IVF to give a reasonable chance of success in terms of attaining a pregnancy. In these cases, we generally don't do just IVF. In earlier programs, I've discussed the difference between IVF and something called ICSI. intracytoplasmic sperm injection. With standard IVF, we put an egg in a test tube with 50 to 100,000 sperm and let them go for it. So nature selects the sperm that enters the egg. With ICSI, what we're doing is taking one single normal looking sperm and injecting it into the egg. This way we make sure that fertilization has occurred. This ICSI technique has produced hundreds of thousands of children over the years since it was first described. And indeed, in some clinics, as high as 80% of cycles are done this way to make sure that fertilization does occur. And we don't run the risk of failed fertilization, even in a normal sperm count. But certainly, if you do IVF with poor sperm counts, the chances of getting an embryo forming is significantly less. So ICSI is the backbone now of the management of couples where the male has a severe quality problem. And with ICSI, what we're achieving is identical pregnancy rates to those patients who have normal fertilization with IVF. So it has changed the face of male infertility. When I started doing IVF some time ago now, back in the 80s, if a male had poor sperm count, even though we did IVF, success rates were appalling. So it was 1992 that a chance finding when someone was fiddling with eggs and sperm and happened to inject the sperm into an egg and produced an embryo that was put back, that we realized that this was a way forward. And ICSI really has revolutionized male infertility. ICSI has been accused, however, of having a higher chance of babies with congenital abnormalities. Most likely this is related to the fact that the sperm we put back, when there are low numbers, and for many of them there is a genetic cause for that low numbers, although most of them we can't identify, it's likely that that sperm is producing abnormalities in the children. But that's still not particularly scary in the sense that of all babies born by nature, something like 3% will have congenital abnormalities. If you do ICSI, it's 4%. It's not a vast difference. And for the other 96%, these are pregnancies that potentially would never otherwise occurred. So ICSI has got some cautionary tales to it, but the important part is it does produce pregnancies where they were never possible in the past. So that's a summary of male infertility. We start with a semen analysis and we work our way through further investigations if there are abnormalities, and we have treatment that is successful, highly successful for the majority of men.
And don't forget that you can access all the previous episodes by going to our website www.theivfjourney.com and select IVF Journey Podcast from the navigation menu.
Thank you for listening to The IVF Journey with Dr. Michael Chapman, the podcast which helps couples negotiate their way through the IVF journey all the way to parenthood. You can also ask questions by contacting Dr. Chapman's rooms on 1-800-111-483 or by emailing him michael.chapman@ivf.com.au.